This is we're in chapter 4. This is like the pinnacle and the conclusion. So that's pretty unusual that it like doesn't wait till the very end, and then it has some very, very surprising plot twists, even in this little part of it, which you would think we were discussing God playing chess, how he had arranged the board, how he had arranged the people, and this week it's checkmate on, you know, any nefarious plans for what was going on here. It'll be really, we'll be able to, like, peek behind the veil. And again, I told you, we are not victims, but we are grown up in a Greek philosophy on prophecy, in that in our book, in our way of viewing things, somebody tells us something, then that's fulfilled. We see that as prophetic. In the more Jewish and Hebrew mindset, there's more of models. We see somebody as a model of something. Something's modeled for them. Remember, they were, I don't want to say illiterate, but there was a class of people that could write, and the other class of people depended on them for their scriptures, for their, to get the scriptures to them. That was the priest's job, to bring, you know, Yahweh to the people. And, you know, obviously we've seen in the book of Judges, and what's really, really awesome, you see that in the book of Judges, we just saw this horrible, degenerative kind of way that people were at, but this takes place inside of that. So there was this nugget of goodness and love, and all, there's always a remnant. There's always, and I think there's just hope in that when we see our world just deteriorating beneath our feet, that there's always a remnant. There's always those people who God just holds on to and just loves them. And we're going to see a picture of that. So where we kind of ended was, if you'll remember, Boaz, Ruth had laid at his feet, and he had put his hem of his garment over her, which was his rank. And now he's basically said, she said, will you marry me? And he said, yes, I offer you shelter. I offer you everything. But we're going to find out there's a little after that, there's a little glitch in the system, and then there's a closer redeemer. There's somebody closer to Boaz, to her, that, you know, could fulfill the Levirate marriage, or the redemption, I should say. So we saw, but Boaz, as you saw, he gave her some, basically sent her home with 6 measures of barley, which we said was basically a code, because when she gets home, Naomi knows exactly what it means. So just like God did not, you know, didn't rest till the 7th day, on the 6th day, he was still finishing. Boaz basically sent her home with 6 measures, saying, I'm not going to rest until this matter is settled. So that's where we kind of pick up where we are now and where we're going to start today. So,
Hello.
Hello. So we're going to pick up today with where Boaz is going to try to fulfill, you know, and keep his promise of he's not resting. So obviously, go back to the story, Boaz and Ruth woke up at O Dark 30. And he basically, to keep her reputation, he told her, don't let anybody see you here. You know, kind of get home, and I'll deal with this. So he's been up since O Dark 30, and as we can see, here he goes. And so it says, now, verse 1, Ruth 4, now Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there. And we learned that in all these walled villages, which that's what a village offered, was protection, as opposed to people that lived out, the farmers out in their fields, there would be a village that would be walled that would offer protection. And obviously everything going in and out of that village went through that gate. There would be a gate in the wall. And that's where the elders sat and conducted business, because then they could see who's coming in and out. Do they owe taxes to us? Do, you know, all the things that are going on in the city pass through the city gate. So that's where the elders sit. So you can see, Boaz goes up, and he doesn't feel uncomfortable sitting down there, which tells you, gives you a hint to his stature in this place. He's one of the leaders of this area. Because you're going to see, he looks like a guy that pretty much is used to giving orders. As you can see by, you know, he was out in the field. He told, do this, do this, do this. He kind of continues that. And behold, the Redeemer. So here's the, we would have the dun, dun, dun. So here's the other person that's in the story that is the relative that is kind of throwing, someone looks like going to throw a wrench into the monkey works here. And he says, this, behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, turn aside, friend, sit down here. And he turned aside and sat down. So Boaz, if he didn't have any ranking or wasn't a person to be reckoned with, this guy would have probably said, look, I'm busy. I don't have time to sit here and jaw with you. But he obviously, so this shows the importance of both of them. Then he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit down here. So he sat down. It was interesting. You couldn't, there's nothing really says anything about the 10 men. I was kind of looking for some secret. But basically, you could not have, evidently, a synagogue with less than 10 members. 10 members was the threshold where you could have, that it was considered legitimate. So I guess, I don't know if that carries on into here where he's saying, you know, you need at least 10 witnesses for this to be legitimate. You know, we're going to see a land transaction, basically, where this can be legitimate. So, and he said, and he tells these 10 guys, sit down here, and they sit down. So obviously, again, showing that he's a pretty important player. Then he said to the Redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling a parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. Some translations say our brother Elimelech. Some people take that literally, like it was whoever this guy is. This was his uncle. This was Elimelech's brother, literally his brother. Other things just say it's a relative. I there's nothing here that really tells you. The only thing you can get is that this guy is closer than Boaz to Naomi in you know, their relation in the line of their family. So he's telling him, so I thought I would tell of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one besides you to redeem it, and I come after you. And he said, I will redeem it. So he basically said, hey, you know, either you want this and you don't, it's, and if you don't want it, I do. Then, and the guy says, and he said, I will redeem it. So you can imagine, you kind of threw the story up to this point, if you just read that, you get a feeling that Boaz has feelings for Ruth. He's pledged to marry her and offer her protection, but if this guy steps in, none of that means anything. So this is the point where he's like, but he does a really, really kind of neat, true thing here. He said, then Boaz said, the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth, the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. It's funny, and I didn't go through the whole, I was listening to and reading some things. When Ruth's first introduced in the book in chapter 1, she is a stranger. In chapter 2, the Jewish word that's used for it is the lowest form of servant, when she's in the field gleaning. In chapter 3, it says she's a maidservant. So she's moved up. So what's really funny, at the end of this, she's going to be a wife. But at this point, he brings up the point, she's a Moabite. Just remember that, you know. And we're told never to marry Moabites. Right? Just think about that. So you'll see how this plays a really interesting part. Then the Redeemer said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it. And I plant all these words in your head, because we're going to come back and we're going to build a picture at the end that I was looking at the picture and I was building in my mind the roles of the people. And again, I'm going to make the point that these people are modeling something that's going to be very, very important in the future. And then this guy throws like a wrench into that model. He's thinking, oh, it fits very neatly to put it in a box. And I wrestled with that. I obviously have had 2 weeks to kind of, and I was like, I can't understand what this guy does. And I can't understand his part in it. And somebody introduced me to something. It's kind of an interesting, it'll take a minute for it. I've you know, marinated on it for a couple days. And it was a really, really interesting take on who this guy is. And so just remember verse 6, the words. When we play out at the end, it'll be kind of important. Now, this was the customs in the former times of Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging to confirm a transaction. One drew off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was the manner of attesting in Israel. If you remember, when we went back, when we studied the process of redemption in the beginning, when we looked at it, the way the process basically worked was the wife whose husband had died went to her relative and basically said, hey, your brother's dead. You need to marry me. I need to have a son so that this land can stay in my, you know, in my family. I have, you know, I'm secure for the rest of my life. Well, if that guy, it was a really, really big thing for him to say no. Because, and there were some reasons for that. You could kind of have, and we're going to explore that, that you could have, basically what happened is you would pay for this land. Now, you would get this wife, but when she had a son, he would get your brother's name. And when he grew up, the land was his. It wasn't in your family. It was in his family. So it was a big deal. It was a commitment to be a redeemer. You just don't get, oh, good, like I got another, you know, 40 or 50 acres, or I got another plot of land. The way it was meant to work out was you would have a son with your brother's wife. When his son grew up, he would have your brother's name, and he would take the land back. He would take possession of the land. So it was commitment. So there's reasons people say, nah, I ain't doing this. Because then, if that son was the eldest son of your group, say you had 3 daughters or something, he got a double portion of your property. So it was, you know, we just look at it like, hey, you know, this guy's being, you know, but God said do this. But there was reasons people would say no. And obviously, in those cases, what would happen was the wife, the widow, would get his sandal and spit in his face. And he would, remember we talked about, he would have to walk around the village, and he was called the guy with one sandal, or the shoeless guy. Well, there's a couple interpretations of that. So it was meant to be a little bit of a shaming that, so, I kind of, then you get looking at this, and it's a whole different thing here, and you think about, and here it says, so when the Redeemer said to Boaz, buy it for yourself, and drew off his sandal, who is petitioning the Redeemer? An intercessor. In the Bible, and under the law, in reality, this should have been Naomi petitioning him. But Boaz said, I'll do this. He interceded for her and obviously for Ruth to say, let me take care of this. I'll deal with this. So it's a really, really interesting thing that you have an intercessor, and so did they. So we're going to see it's kind of developing the model of who. Obviously, we've talked about Boaz being, you know, the role of the Redeemer. You know, he's the Lord of the harvest. All those, so we're obviously placing him in a model of God, of Yahweh, God the Father. He's not God, but it's just a model we can build through that. So it's interesting here that he is interceding for them and taking care of, because Naomi's kind of never been, it's interesting, Naomi was never really with Boaz. you'll kind of see through the story, which is kind of interesting. So then, verse 9. That Boaz said to the elder and all the people, you are witness today that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and to Mahlon, and Ruth, the Moabite of Mahlon, which is kind of fun, because his name means sickly, remember? And I don't know if they named him because he was sickly or if they named him and then he was sickly. Don't know. But that's what his name meant. I have bought to be my wife to perpetrate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his relative's place. You are a witness this day. Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, we are the witness. May the Lord make this woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthy in Ephrathah, which is basically, it says Ephrathah, but it's really the same, another spelling of Ephrathah, which is their tribe. And be renowned in Bethlehem, which is kind of interesting because they're going to be very renowned. And may your house be like the house of Perez, who Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring of the Lord will give you by this young woman. That's a toast, right? That's a great, really, it's a backhanded slap at the end, because we're going to learn, does anybody remember the story of how Perez came to be? So real quickly, I have it here. We can read through it. It's a very sordid story. Obviously, the Bible doesn't go through and make it all, you know, roses and unicorn, you know, dust or whatever. It gives you the bad side. So basically what happens here, and this is really interesting because I have read this a few times. You can tell I like the Old Testament. I kind of go through it. But Judah, who was going to be the line of the tribe of Judah, the Messiah was going to come through the line of Judah, ends up marrying a Canaanite woman. So that was against the law. Now you have so I can make this point throughout history. When Genesis chapter 3, when God declared war on Satan, put enmity between your seed and her seed, Satan knew that mankind was his enemy from that point, that he had to stop. So to me, my own thing, that's the whole Genesis 6 little adventure, was Satan trying to pollute the line of humanity. The Messiah had to come through that line. If I make it polluted with non-human DNA, I've polluted the line of the Messiah. So that didn't work out because God, you know, that's when things said no. Was a man perfect in his generations? So God wiped out everybody, started over with Noah. You know, then all of a sudden, right at that point, we get to the Tower of Babel. God says to everybody, okay, I've had enough of this. You guys won't listen. The world's going to go its own way, but I'm taking Abraham, and this, I point out the divine counsel stuff and that, but I'm taking Abraham, and I'm putting a people set aside for myself. So with that, Pharaoh tried to wipe out Israel. So there's the war. So, okay, we started with mankind. Now I'm down to a group of ethnic people, and here is my war on that ethnic group. Then he says, Judah, so here's part of the war. This is kind of behind the scenes. I never really noticed this before, but he married a Canaanite woman. It was against the law. So now the line of the tribe of Judah, the Messiah, was going to come through a corrupted line. Well, guess what? The oldest son married Tamar, and it never says Tamar is Canaanite. You don't really get, you know, you can kind of make the impression she might be Jewish. So then it says he did evil in the sight of the Lord, so he killed him. So we went back, everybody remembered a Levirate marriage, we were just talking about it, so he had to give her to his second son, who hopefully they would have a son, and they would get their land back. Well, that was the way the law was written, but got his brother, how would you put this? He did not consummate the marriage the way he should have. So God said, that's evil, you're gone. Boom. Two out of three sons of Judah have been kicked out of the tent, so, or gone to the happy hunting ground, whatever you. So now Tamar has to wait. He says, wait till my youngest son gets a little older and I'll give him to you. You guys can get married. Well, she's waiting around all the time. So evidently you were, and again, I'm paraphrasing all this. I put it in here if anybody wants to read it. She wore a widow's garment. Evidently in that time to denote. Remember how we talked about your rank was in your hem? Evidently if you were a widow, you dressed a certain way that said, I'm a widow. So she's waiting and waiting. Well, Judah doesn't fulfill his part of the vow. So his wife dies. So now Judah's just off, like, wandering around. He said, well, they're shearing the sheep up in, you know, somewhere, Never Never Land. I'm going to go along with the guys and, you know, join the party for a little while just to get out of the tent. So Tamar hears this. So she takes off her widow's clothes and puts on the dress that a harlot would wear. And evidently you wore a veil over your face was part of that profession. And she goes up and sits somewhere that she knows he's going to be. So he comes walking by. She entices him. They do what you would do with a prostitute. And he's like, well, she's like, you owe me something now. And he's like, well, I'm going to give you a lamp. And she says, well, that ain't helping me right now. Give me something now. So he gives her his staff and his signet ring. Then he leaves. Well, she bolts out of there, goes back to the tent, puts on her widow's clothes. Nobody's the wiser till 3 months later. I assume she starts to show that she is pregnant. So Judah hears your daughter-in-law is pregnant. He's furious. He's like, I'm going to bring her here. I'm going to burn her. That's what he actually says. So then when she shows up, he's like, well, who's the father? And she's like, I don't know, the guy left these things, the signet ring and the staff. So he immediately confesses that you are holier than I am. And the point of that story was, hey, God always seems behind the scenes to have, so here was an attempt at saving the corrupt, the Davidic line. And he steps in, has an alternate plan, and sorted as that is, she ends up having Perez. Which, so you go back to the toast, and they're basically saying, may your family line be as corrupt as this one, basically, you know? But there's a reason for it. It's really a prophecy, and we're going to see that too. I'll come back to that one. The other thing I had to go through is we're going to talk about a king, which as we went through the whole book of Judges, constantly says that Israel had no king, and Israel had no king. Well, if we go into Samuel, you'll kind of get the feeling that the feeling you kind of get is God wanted to be the king, they didn't want him to be the king, so they picked another guy. But if you read the book, and I put it in here, it's all the way back in Deuteronomy, which is up here. God gave the rules for a king. So it wasn't God didn't want them to have a king, or they weren't going to have a king. God was just preparing the right guy. And finally, he's like, I think sometimes he gives you what you want to make you appreciate what you should have gotten when you finally get what he was really going to give you. Yeah. So, you know, some of the best gifts from God are those unanswered prayers, right? So some of the answered prayers might not be everything you hoped they were. So with that, we'll go on. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Then the woman said to Naomi, remember, they're not talking to Ruth now, this is to Naomi, who lost her sons, who lost her husband. Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life, a nourisher in your old age, for your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more than seven sons, has given birth to him. Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. And what's, you can go back to the word nurse. There's a couple, there's a word for wet nurse. There's all these other. But this, when I was looking at a couple of them, said that the Hebrew word for nurse used here is actually a word for protector. So she's not only grandma, she's a, you know, going to fight if anybody messes with Perez. Because you got to understand, he's a daughter of a Moabite. But guess what? Do you know anybody know who Boaz's mom was? Anybody remember a woman that dropped a scarlet thread down on the wall?
Rhea.
Yep. So he already kind of, he's like, I have a tainted background and I've achieved. Obviously, he's a leader in this. So he's like, I got no problem with this. And it's really an interesting picture of grace that we see. So the women of the neighborhood gave him names, saying, a son has been born in Naomi. They named him Obed, the father of Jesse and the father of David. So Obed, it wasn't Perez. Perez was back in the other side of things. So all of a sudden you would think nothing of it. It ends there. It's a beautiful book. You know, love story. And the Holy Spirit just went in here and stuck this little genealogy in here. It says, now these are the generations of Perez. Because somebody uttered a toast at the wedding, if you will, that was really kind of a backhanded slap. So now the Holy Spirit's going and is going to be, this is the reason for that. Now these are the generations of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Abimadad. Abimadad fathered Nashon. Nashon fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse. Jesse fathered David. So there's all those times you kind of go through. I know it goes through Chronicles, and there's some places and where you're reading all these like lineages, and you're like, oh my God, this is crazy. Why do I nothing in here? Do I need to know? This is just, you know, a genealogy table. What do I care? Well, it's kind of interesting because we're going to go into Deuteronomy 23, 2 and 3, which it's amazing. No, and here's what it says. No one of illegitimate birth may enter the assembly of the Lord, nor may any of descendants, even to the 10th generation. Guess how many generations it was from Perez to David? 10. Then verse 3, no Ammonite or Moabite and any of their descendants may enter to the assembly of the Lord even to the 10th generation. So again, there's this like, this is going to show you what a picture of grace this is. That the law said this is not going to happen. But the thing that changed Ruth, and I believe what God was, and it tells you why. For he did not meet you with food and water on your way out of Egypt, and they hired Balaam the son of Beor from Pethor to curse you. And we hopefully all know that story. But what the bottom line was, and we see it time after time in the Bible, was the kings and other people would end up marrying these women. They had grown up worshiping the Canaanite gods. And slowly but surely, the husbands would end up turning and worshiping these idols, false gods, other deities, however you want to put it. And God, that was God's warning against, that's going to happen if you do this. But what is the exception about Ruth? What was her, what she gave seven things to Naomi when she said, I'm not leaving. She said, your God will become my God. So she completely changed. accused no longer, which I can make you, and we'll go, okay, so we'll add that to the list of things we're going to go through now. So, anybody have anything? Who do you think in the story, if you were going to model, who does Ruth model?
I think it's the church.
The church. Well done, Richard. She models the church. She's a Gentile. The crazy part about it is this is a picture originally of what was supposed to happen was the people were going to be God's people in the land. And that did not work out. So God's given you a hint of what's going to happen. Anybody know what the diaspora is? No? AD 70, Romans destroyed Rome, killed a couple million Jews, and what did the rest of the people do? Or they were taken slaves and sent throughout the kingdom. That's called, they were dispersed. That's what the diaspora is. Ruth, Naomi had to leave the promised land before she could show Ruth the way back to meet the Lord of the harvest. But it took Ruth, the church, to introduce Naomi to the Lord of the harvest, the Redeemer. So there's all this model building. So then you get this weird thing. And like I say, so here you go. Here's this perfect picture of God's plan. You have the diaspora. From the diaspora, that's the early church. I mean, it was AD 70. So the church is just flourishing. The Pentateuch and the books of the prophets go out into all the Gentile world, which kind of what was the original plan anyway. From that, those people are brought back and introduced to the Messiah, and from that, the church is born and redeemed. God redeemed the land and got a Gentile bride. So that's the picture of Revelation. Well, who is this other redeemer? So that was what I wrestled with. I'm like, okay, I clearly see the picture. Boaz, which is really interesting because his main name means strength. He is one of, there's two pillars in the temple that really don't hold up anything, but they're built, and one of them is named Boaz. So when it says, may your name be great in, you know, history and in Bethlehem, why do you think Joseph and Mary went back to Bethlehem when they were to be, because they were in the lineage of David, which is this story. You can make, there's speculation, and I don't, so it never really tells you this field. So obviously, Boaz had his own field. He was redeeming another field for Naomi, and there's a case to be made that when the angels appeared at the birth to the shepherds, what field were they in? This field. So that's just really, really cool. So now back to this kind of like, you're like, what is this other thing? And I wrestle with this all week. I'm like, it just blows the picture apart. What if the other character is the law? And the law could point you and bring you to the Redeemer, but it could not redeem you. And it says,
the law, he says, I can't do it.
Yes, I cannot redeem you. And that's why I told you to remember verse 6. That the other guy says, I can't redeem you. And that's what the law does. Still brought you to know that you needed a redeemer, but it couldn't redeem you. So,
which would have been the closer one?
Right. So the Jews were closer to the law than they were the Messiah, but the law could not save them. Anybody?
I actually have a question in Deuteronomy when it comes to the people not allowed to go to the way of, what is it, of God, of the Lord? Not even the 10th generation can't, what, of the Lord? The Moabites,
the Canaanites. can enter the assembly of the Lord.
So, what exactly would the assembly be
at? At that time, it was to go to the tabernacle and partake of the sacrifices, the festivals, all that kind of stuff. So you'll see that carried on later in the temple. There's actually a court of the Gentiles, which was even if you became a proselyte, right? Is that what it is, proselyte? Is that somebody's been proselytized by Judaism, and now you want to become a Jew, but you're a Gentile? You still could not enter into the proper temple. There was a special space. It was called the Court of the Gentiles, where you could go to the temple, but you couldn't go in completely.
So it's not saying that they can't be Jews. It's just saying that that sacred area isn't for people that aren't
of Jewish descent. Right.
Okay.
And that was only going to remain until the real temple, if you will, came. That was why the veil was ripped. There was no longer a need to have a priest to approach God on your behalf and go through all these ceremonial cleans. He said, come to me, talk. You have access to the throne room of God through the blood shed on the cross. We don't need this veil anymore. We don't need this. We don't need all this sacrifice. It was never about, you know, I mean, what joy would God get out of killing an innocent little animal? The point he was trying to say is you had to go into that sacrifice as the head of the house. You put your hand on that animal's head. The priest would slice its throat, and you had to touch it until it bled out and died. He was showing you how much somebody was going to have to go through to cover your sin. That what this animal was suffering for was all that you had done wrong. And eventually somebody would suffer the ultimate fate to take that animal's place. So God doesn't need the animals anymore. So that was just, a model. I'm just modeling for you what's happened. Boaz is obviously not God, but he's a model of a redeemer. First off, he has to be a kinsman. I can even go into, we could go into Revelation 5, which I was kind of tempted to do. But so there's a scroll presented. John's in heaven. It's in the throne room of heaven. And again, Chris is paraphrased. He's presented. They're saying there's a scroll that needs to be opened. It's the title deed to earth. And John starts weeping, saying, there's nobody worthy. No man has been able to live such a perfect life that he's there. If you understand what a title deed scroll was and why it was, so you would write what you had to do to open the scroll was written on the outside. But then the title deed was on the inside. So let's just say you had to pay, you know, 10,000 shekels for this land. You had to, you know, march to the east twice, and whatever the instructions were would be on the outside. And then once you completed those instructions, you were okay to open the scroll. Well, when this is presented in heaven, John starts crying. He starts convulsively weeping because it's like there's nobody worthy that he says Jesus. He says, the lamb that was slain. And that's how John introduced him. It's not the lion of the tribe of Judah. It's the lamb that was slain that now has completed all the things on the outside of the scroll that he can take the scroll and now, and that's when you get the seven seals. He's going to unroll and say, okay, this is the first seal, this is the second seal. So the scroll continually, so you would pull it out, say, you know, 24 inches of it unrolls before you get to the next wax seal. You can't open it, you know. So this had a group of things to be fulfilled. Then you would open the next seal. Then you would go to the third seal. And that's what the picture in Revelation is giving you when it says, and the scroll was opened and the seals were broken. So that's how much this model goes from Genesis to Revelation.
I have another view. It's a little different.
Okay, I'm cool. I didn't write it.
No,
you ain't fucking with me.
Okay. I agree with everything you said.
That's a good thing.
Okay. But I had a different way of looking at Boaz. Okay? Boaz would be also a picture of Joseph. Because Boaz is following the law. Joseph's following the law because he's going to marry away silently. He didn't because he was visited by the angel. Boaz went to the congregation and fulfilled the law by taking the witnesses. And then the clincher was when it says in the, and I only caught that after you read it, though. I got to admit, I will say it. The Lord gave her conception. Who gave Mary a conception? And that, so not only is it he's redeemed her, and he portrayed the Redeemer, but he also portrayed Joseph, because now he's understood as his father, but he's the substitute father for the father, and it's.
I can't argue with that.
It's just very weird how he can fill both roles. And Joseph never tried to be God.
Right.
And I'm not saying he did, but he can portray two roles in the same story. Very clear. I mean, to me, it's clear. As soon as you said the conception was by the Lord, I was like, I read through that, and I never even put that in there until...
I'm telling you, we could go back to this book and start at chapter 1 and find something new every week to talk about. It's amazing. I could go back when it says, Boaz said, I will not rest till this task is done. Does that remind you of Jesus setting his face like a flint to the cross? Alright, so anybody, anything
else?
Go ahead, Rich.
Yeah, and also, Boaz was a type of Christ because of the Redeemer kinsman. And then about the Moabites, these heathens, like we were, I assume before we were saved we were lost in sin, and Jesus found us. Then we found him. It's a relationship. We come together because of him. He made us aware that we needed him through the Holy Spirit, right? But when you go back to the Moabites and all those heathens, when I say that, I'm not attacking anything. I'm just telling the truth. It's like they were unsaved, and they were worshiping, like you said there, the Moabites and different ones there. It's more than them, different names. They were worshiping all these gods and trying to, and the difference about Israel, right? They were to worship the one and only true living God, right? A true God was only one God, not many gods. So that's why they were not supposed to go in there and get involved in a marriage like that. But let me say this. Through grace, even though the law is honorable, we don't discredit the law. We need the Old Testament. There's one pastor, I ain't mentioning no names. He said we no longer need the Old Testament. All we need is the New Testament. But I thought, that don't sound right, because we can't do away with it. It's beneficial. But what I want to say, hopefully I don't get off and lose my strength.
Well, how many sermons did Jesus preach out of the New Testament?
I know. Yeah. So I don't know how he did that. His father didn't believe that way, but he chose, he made a statement that he says,
well,
we don't need that.
Anybody?
But the Moabites, the thing of it is with the heathen, if perhaps by the revelation of the Lord, he reveals himself to them, and a person gets saved out of no matter whatever tribe they're coming out of, that changes everything different. So that's where this comes in, where they're through the seed of Christ. You know what I mean?
That's the Genesis all the way back. She represented the church.
It makes a difference.
In that, I remember the whole thing with Peter and the sheep when it came down. So I've never eaten anything unclean. Jesus said, what's unclean?
Right.
Not, I made it all.
Yeah.
You know, so that was so, I'll let you, and I gave Mike this assignment, and he didn't come through. The calendar. I was discussing it with, so in the beginning of this, I hate to go all the way back, but let's just say, there's three, we call it the Passover, but there's really three festivals that are the Passover. And it ends with the feast on the Sunday after Passover, the other two. It's called the Feast of First Fruits. And it's a Sunday. It's the first day of the week for them is the Feast of First Fruits. Which, I mean, it's a Sunday. Which when Jesus was resurrected, that was on a Sunday. He said, I'm the first fruits, right? Well, even in the Jewish calendar, 50 days later, there's the Feast of Sabbat. We would call it the Pentecost because it's 50 days. It's Greek. Word for 50 is penta. We get the Pentateuch. So 50 days later is the Feast of Sabbat. They read this book at that time. The Jewish people, for no other reason than the reason, they read this book at the Feast of Pentecost. And I just think that's amazing. It's the only feast with unleavened bread, which leaven represents sin. Remember, Jesus said a little leaven leavens the whole loaf. You get a little bit of sin, everybody joins in. But it's interesting that they actually have a feast in Israel that involves leavened bread, and it's Pentecost. So it's more and more a picture of the church, and more he just laid lead. That's what I'm saying. You can go back to this book and just find a million more things to talk about. It's one of the funnest books in the Bible. To me, I just found that interesting. All right. Anybody want to close in prayer? Because I'm getting to be that time. I'll do it. Heavenly Father, just thank you for this day. Just thank you for these people that they're willing to come out and just hear from you, Lord. Thank you for blessing me with this time. And again, we just thank you for our body. We thank you for all the comfort and things you offer, Lord, and just speaking to us in this time of trouble and how you just show us that there's always a remnant. There's always a place of comfort. And it's always with you. In Jesus' name, amen. Silence?
Yeah, we have to.
You usually have to.
Next Sunday.
Oh, yes.